Hello. Before we begin, a quick note. The Boy to Sleep podcast relies on you and sponsors, which means you will hear a quick advertisement before the beginning of tonight's episode. While the podcast is free, you are welcome to subscribe for just $2.99 per month, which supports the creation of this podcast and gives you an ad-free listening experience. Simply click the link in the show notes from your podcast app. Rest easy.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello. Welcome to the Bore You to Sleep podcast. The podcast that will hopefully help you get to sleep. I am going to read an open source book, one that is not particularly interesting, but one that is hopefully boring enough to get you to sleep. Tonight's reading comes from Korea, written by A. Hamilton and published in 1904. This story provides a military view of what was happening in Korea around the turn of the 18th century. My name is Teddy, and I am to help people everywhere get a good night's rest. Sleep is so important, and my mission is to help you get the rest that you need. The podcast is designed to play in the background while you slowly fall asleep. For those of you who don't know, this podcast was originally created because I had my own issues with sleep. I wanted to bring another resource to people out there who may have similar issues to my own. The podcast is self-made and self-produced, which is why you'll hear a quick ad at the beginning of each episode. With the help of subscribers and Patreon sponsors, I am able to achieve my goal of keeping this podcast free for those who need it. Thank you to everyone who shared their words of gratitude with me during the week, whether it be through the website or their podcast app. Thank you, of course, to new subscribers of the podcast who are benefiting from an ad-free experience while supporting the show. Thank you, of course, to all existing subscribers and Patreon sponsors. If you find the podcast beneficial and would like to support the podcast, there are a few ways you can contribute. Be sure to follow the podcast in your podcast app. Of course, you are welcome to become a subscriber for $2.99 per month, which will ensure that you remove any Spotify ads at the beginning of the episode. If that is not possible, an easy way to support the podcast is by subscribing and leaving a review and rating in your podcast app. Even one sentence really helps out. You can always say hello to me at boytosleep.com. In the meantime, lie back, relax, and enjoy the readings. Korea by Angus Hamilton. Introduction. Nothing is more natural than the circumstance that war should be the outcome of the existing crisis. Yet equally, nothing is less certain. If the area of hostilities were not confined to the Far East, and the power confronting Japan were any other than Russia, the outbreak of war might be predicted positively. But with Russia, consideration of the strategic qualities of her position in Manchuria must exercise a paramount influence upon her movements. To those who are not close students of military history, as well as to those who do not possess an extensive knowledge of the situation, the position in which Russia is placed equally affords the keenest interest. Certainly, in the annals of military history, excluding the march of Napoleon upon Moscow, there is no war which may be said to have developed a parallel to the task which besets Russia in Manchuria and Korea. Her position at sea, moreover, is no better than that which she holds on land. Upon land, a single line of railway traversing the heart of an enemy's country terminates at Port Arthur. At sea, Vladivostok is cut off by reason of its position, while it is inaccessible on the account of its climate. These points, Port Arthur and Vladivostok, define the extremities of the strategic position which Russia holds in Manchuria. Excluding Vladivostok at this moment from any especial consideration, Port Arthur is left for the opening moves of this campaign. Therefore, Port Arthur, with a single line of communications in its rear, becomes the pivot of the operations. The aspect of Port Arthur from the sea is uninviting. Rugged hills, offshoots from the range of mountains which divides the Liaotung Peninsula, cluster round the bay, and encroaching upon the foreshore and bearing neither trees nor vegetation, impart to the surroundings a desolate and even wild appearance. Within the headlands of the harbour, conforming with the indentations of the coast, there are several bays shallow and unprofitable, but which in time may become an important adjunct to the small area of deep water which the harbour now possesses. Dredging operations have been undertaken, but there is so much to be done that many years must pass before Port Arthur receives any material addition to its very restricted accommodation. The mud brought down by the streams which empty into the harbour has already affected the deep water area, and since the harbour was constructed, these deposits have encroached very considerably upon the depth offshore. At low water steamers, which lie up within 60 feet of the wharf, rest upon mud in little more than a fathom of water, and at the same time the space is so small that it is impossible for a dozen vessels to anchor in the harbour with any comfort. Steamers, if any larger in size than the small coasting boats which call at Port Arthur from China and Japan, must anchor off the entrance, unloading and recharging from junks or tenders. In relation to the requirement of the squadron, Port Arthur is not nearly large enough. When cruisers are taking in stores, battleships remain outside, an arrangement which is manifestly inconvenient in a period of emergency. It was for this reason that the authorities constructed at Dolny, a few miles from the fortress and within Paiten Wan Bay, a new town, together with commercial docks and wharves, in order that Port Arthur might be devoted more particularly to the needs of the navy. Port Arthur is happy in the possession of all those objects which, to a naval base, are component parts of its success. The dry dock, somewhat weak and unsubstantial, is 385 feet in length, 34 feet in depth, and 80 feet broad, while the naval basin is equal in surface space to the total available steamer anchorage in the harbour proper. When the dredging works in the harbour bays have been completed, it is hoped that a mean depth of 4 fathoms will have been obtained. This systematic deepening of the harbour will give to the fleet a surface anchorage considerably in excess of 1 square mile. But until the work has been executed, the value of Port Arthur as a satisfactory naval base is infinitely less than the prestige which it enjoys as an impregnable position. Port Arthur possesses a small parade ground, rifle range, and artillery practice ground, torpedo station and training reservation, which will be enlarged when the bays are opened out. There is a flashlight station and various schools of instruction, torpedo, gunnery, telegraphy, while the arsenals and workshops which are built around the naval basin and within the navy yards are very thoroughly equipped. These effects, however, were mainly taken over by Russia when she seized Port Arthur. Their existence at the present moment tends to show how impossible it is to underestimate the advantages which Russia derives from the possession of this port, and how far-reaching are the consequences of the monstrous blunder which Lord Salisbury committed when he acquiesced in its usurpation. Apart from the defences, Russia, hitherto, has not added much to Port Arthur. For the main part, the troops have been quartered in the old Chinese houses, or in the former barracks of the Chinese troops. Affairs having been somewhat neglected in the view of the prior claim which the defences held. Now, however, fine barracks are in course of construction, and if there is no war, it is anticipated that ample accommodation will be ready soon upon the shores of some of the bays and on the hills. The defences are indeed magnificent. Very few of the forts which were in existence during the time of the Chinese remain. Since the Russian government entered upon possession, the work of extending the perimeter of the defences, as well as strengthening the fortifications, has been a continuous labour. It is quite clear that the authorities are determined upon no half measures. They have gained Port Arthur, and they propose to keep it. Upon the cliffs, rising immediately from the right of the harbour entrance, there is a most powerful position, formed, I believe, of a battery of 6 21-inch Krupp guns, which was further supported by a fort placed a few feet above the harbour, and sweeping its immediate front, containing 8 10-inch Krupps. At the corresponding elevations upon the opposite headland, there were 2 similar forts with identical batteries, while the minefields within the harbour are controlled from these 2 lower positions. Following the hills to the south and north, there are other forts. One in particular, of great size, is placed upon the extreme crest of the range, and towering above all else, sweeps the sea and approaches to the harbour for great distances. It is impossible to detect the character of these guns, but from their position and the extent of the fort and the nature of the part which they are intended to fill, it is improbable that they can be less than 27-ton guns, discharging shells of about 500 pounds. Of course, a fight for the command of the sea must precede any land operations. Japan is within 15 hours' steam of Fusan, already a Japanese garrison town, and a Ma Sun Po, the port to which Russia and Japan make equal claim. The strait separating Japan from Korea is 200 miles broad, while Russia's nearest base at Port Arthur is 900 miles away on one hand, and Vladivostok is 1,200 miles away on the other. It follows, therefore, that in Korea, and not in Manchuria, the troops of the Japanese army would be landed. Once established in Korea, Japan would be able to dispute the supremacy of the sea on equal terms. In this respect, the possession by the Japanese of numerous torpedo craft confers a distinct advantage upon them, since it will be within their power to utilize their services if the Russian fleet were to attempt to check the movement. The absence of any facilities for repairing damages makes it certain that so far as possible the Russian fleet will evade any serious engagement. It would be difficult to improve upon the position of Japan in this respect. At Yokosuka, from which place a large number of cruisers has been launched, there is a very extensive building yard, and Japan also possesses suitable docks for large ships at Kure and Nagasaki. In all, she has at her immediate disposal some half a dozen docks, 400 feet in length or more, and a very skillful army of working mechanisms and workmen in general. Port Arthur must be regarded for practical purposes the naval base of Russia in the Far East in the event of a cold weather campaign. Vladivostok is too far removed from the range of probable utility. At this port, however, Russia has constructed one large dry dock, one floating dock 301 feet long, and a second dry dock has been laid down. Against these two solitary and isolated centers, Japan possesses naval bases, arsenals, and docks at the following points on her coast. The squadrons which Japan and Russia will be able to employ in this war are very formidable, and during the past few months each power has made strenuous efforts to increase the strength of its fleet. In the exigencies of active service, it happens that the Russian soldier must forage for himself. Under any circumstances, however, he sustains himself on very little nourishment, and relies in a great measure upon what he can find. The Russian cavalry is armed with sword, rifle, and bayonet. The latter is invariably carried fixed, even when the weapon itself is slung. A few regiments only carry the lance. The field guns are steel breech loaders manufactured at the Obukhov works. They are akin to the Krupp pattern. Many, however, have the uninterrupted screw breech piece and the debange obturation. At present, there are many varieties of artillery with the Russian troops, particularly in their fortified positions, to which places the Russian transported the sieges which they made from the Chinese during the Boxer crisis. These embraced French, German, and British examples of artillery. On land, the immense superiority of the reserve numbers of the Russian reduces the advantages which would accrue to the Japanese if the fighting were confined to the sea. At the same time, however, it should be remembered that the Russian troops are slow movers, and although they may exhibit magnificent endurance, and although they may be relied upon to fight well, the lack of individual initiative upon the part of the Russian officers robs the operations of that dash and address which is embodied in the spirit of the Japanese army. curiously enough, each side favours the Continental School of Infantry and Cavalry Tactics. The underlying principles in the training of the Japanese, revealing a close adherence to the Teutonic methods. Neither side will profit, therefore, by any degree of indivisibility to which they may have attained. The winter great coat of either army is very nearly identical in colour, and for warm weather, Japanese and Russians alike favour a white blouse. There has been talk of the Japanese adopting a khaki tint, upon the other hand. The blouse of the Russian soldier is by courtesy equally white or khaki. In the more important direction of land transport, it might appear that the Manchurian Railway would be a crowning triumph for the Russian authorities. Unfortunately, this immense length of rail, badly laid and indifferently equipped, will impose a perpetual strain upon the military resources. If the country population could be relied upon to maintain a benevolent neutrality towards telegraph poles and lines, railway sleepers and rails, the stone pillar and baulks of the bridges, the possibility of any serious interruption of traffic would be materially lessened. Unhappily for the Russians, the attitude and acts of the native population, who, in a general way, will lose no opportunity to harass their enemy, must impede the effective cooperation of the Russian forces. Against the instinctive feeling of animosity, there may be set the racial sympathy with the Japanese, which governs every Chinese citizen. In Manchuria, particularly, the Japanese enjoy a high reputation in the minds of the populace, while there is remembered, above aught else, that prompt redemption of all obligations during the Chino-Japanese War, which distinguished the policy of the invaders towards local interests. This policy of benevolence was exhibited for the second time during the Boxer Crisis, and of course the striking example offered by the Japanese in comparison with the Russians was not lost upon the Chinese. These things are recalled today in Manchuria, and they may be calculated to offset any reactionary sentiment which may take place in Korea. Between the hospital arrangements of each belligerent, there is little to choose. The more efficient system of the Japanese service is equalized by the greater facilities which the possession of railway communication by the Russians will present to the transportation of the wounded. It should be pointed out, however, that the principal medical service, the Russian Red Cross Society, is wholly patriotic, and that it is not, in any degree, a military organization. It is liable to be withdrawn from the field at any moment, after the conclusion of the major operations. Beyond these few observations, it is difficult, if not impossible, to trespass with any certainty, although as a closing remark, it may perhaps be added that, providing the investment of Port Arthur be satisfactorily accomplished by sea, and that Vladivostok were enclosed by ice, the estuaries of the Yalu and Lyco rivers enables an admirable position to be taken up, from which the Russian position throughout Manchuria may be very readily threatened. Speculations as to the development of the campaign upon land are, however, quite absurd until something is known of the results of the naval engagements with which the war must open. Meanwhile, the painful familiarity with the costs of war which distinguishes the British taxpayer, has been directed no little attention to the financial position of either country. An eminent German financier, interested in the public debt of Russia, lately explained to me that a very large proportion of the monies which have been raised for the construction of the Russian inter-railway communications, in addition to the Trans-Siberian and Manchurian railways, has been set aside from time to time to supplement her war chest. These sums, added to those collected by Count Moraviev, with the assent of M. de Witt, and including the large balances which have accrued to the state by departmental economies during the past year, represent approximately a capital of 100 million sterling. Against this accumulation, it is said that the financial position of Japan is most favourable. There is, I believe, a specie reserve in the central bank, which amounts to 113 million yen, plus 40 million yen in London. Moreover, the bank's notes issuing margin is 35 million yen, which will be larger after the new year. The Treasury has three capital funds amounting together to 50,000 yen, besides some millions in London, remaining from the bond sale of 1902. Finally, there are large sums lying idle in all the banks throughout the country, while an ordinance has been issued which provides the government with unlimited credit. The more recent action of the Russians in Manchuria tends, of course, to support the view that war may be imminent. Nevertheless, bluff is a component part of Russian diplomacy, and there is ground for believing that the intentions of Russia in the Far East are by no means so warlike as the preparations now proceeding, and the acts of the Russian administrative officials in Manchuria itself would imply. Russian diplomacy always covers the development of its plans by preparing to demonstrate in a contrary direction, and at the present time, her occupation of Korean territory is little else than the screen, behind which she proposes to secure her hold upon Manchuria. Nothing short of war will cause her to retire from her position in Manchuria. But while Korean territory is of little value to the Russian protectorate, whatever the compromise which may be effected between Japan and Russia, she may be expected to make a determined effort to dominate the lower waters of the Yalu River. In fact, curious as it may seem, the estuary of the Yalu River is the very locale of the dispute between the two powers, since if Russia were ever permitted to dominate the Yalu River, she would gain at once that special position upon the frontiers of Korea, which it is the desire of Japan to frustrate. In this, Japan can only rely upon the short shifts of diplomacy, and although the Russian occupation of Yong'anpo may be circumvented, the development of Antung upon the opposite shore of the river cannot be prevented. It seems, therefore, as inevitable that some commanding position upon the Yalu River must ultimately fall to her lot. Antung lies within Manchurian territory. The Yalu River is the border stream between Manchuria and Korea, and at Yong'anpo the nucleus of an important Russian settlement has been established. The future contains no promise of the immediate settlement of the present difficulty. At best, the outlook is confused, while at the same time there is presented in a manner singularly clear and comprehensible the fact that Russia neither will evacuate Nuchang, be driven out of Manchuria, nor abandon her position on the Yalu River. The position of Russia at Nuchang has been indicated by past events. Her occupation of Manchuria is an old story, and she is now engaged in the rapid development of her interests at Yangtung. The position of this port endows it with unusual advantages, and the commercial potentialities of the place are very great. It lies about 15 miles above Yong'anpo on the opposite bank. At present, the export trade is confined to millet and silk cocoons. The overproduction of the latter commodity, requiring close technical supervision. 8 miles below Antung, situated on the right bank of the river, is the Lichen Station Santau Lantau, where junks and rafts must report and pay the stipulated excise before they proceed onward. The river then bears away to the northeast, and after another stretch of 7 miles, there comes Antung, upon the same bank, at a point where the stream divides, the eastern branch being the Yalu River. Antung is of quite recent construction, and a few years ago millet fields occupied its site. Under the care of native merchants, large, solid-looking houses have been built, broad streets have been opened out, and an air of unusual prosperity distinguishes the place. The anchorage is thronged with junks, while timber is stacked in vast quantities below the limits of the town. Seagoing steamers of the coaster type can here discharge and load their cargoes, thus obviating transshipment at Ta Tung Kau. Trade between Ta Tung Kau, which is situated at the mouth of the Yalu, and Chifu, is at present carried on by small steamers of the Mosquito Flotilla, and one British ship, the Huang Ho, of the China Navigation Company, while the vast volume of the exports and imports finds its way hither and thither in Chinese junks. The run from Chifu Port is one of 185 miles, and the time usually occupied in the trip northeastward is 22 hours. The steam is anchoring in the Fairway Channel at a distance of 4 miles from Ta Tung Kau. Ta Tung Kau is a very busy town, inasmuch as it is the place of transshipment for imports and exports, most of which go to or come from Antung. The fact of steamers being unable to approach Ta Tung Kau makes Antung the real business center of the Yalu River. In respect of Antung, 200 Russian cavalry have been stationed there for over 2.5 years. The cantonment is situated on a small hill, marking the northern limit of the town, which has no wall. As usual, through the Yalu Valley, these soldiers bear an evil reputation among the natives, from whom they commandeer at pleasure. Striking away from Antung is the Pekin Great Road, which runs into Laoyang. Above Antung, the river divides and shoals exist, the water being so shallow that none but native craft can ply. Weiju is situated about 10 miles to the eastward, and at a point west of Mao Kuishan, 4 miles below Antung, there is the terminus of the branch of the Manchurian Railway, which is to strike the river. The construction of this work will begin in the spring of 1904. The first 80 miles offer little obstruction, and it is intended that the work shall be pushed forward until its junction with the main line of the system is accomplished. Russia, therefore, cannot well afford to ignore the consequences of her policy in the Far East. nor at the same time can she be expected to sacrifice at the request of Japan. Those great interests which she has been at such pains to foster. The position is indeed a striking example of the manner in which an imperious policy will create the taste, if not necessity, for imperialism. The position of Korea in regard to the disputed questions is a hopeless one. Unfortunately, the government of Korea is so powerless to prevent either the advance of Russia or the steady spread of Japanese influence. She possesses neither army nor navy which can be put to any practical use, and she is in that position in which a country is placed when unable to raise its voice upon its own behalf. The army numbers a few thousand men, who in the last few years have been trained to use of Europe.